Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Lynn welcomes Dr. Pasquale Patrizio. Dr. Patrizio is professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale School of Medicine and director of the Yale Fertility Center. Here's Lynn Wilson.
Let's start off by having you tell our audience a little bit about what you do with respect to patients with cancer.
This is a very important topic for the discussion of tonight. We do have an urgent need for patients that are in a reproductive age that have either not completed their family or not even started their family, and that unfortunately are diagnosed with cancer. Until 12 years ago, there were not too many options for these patients. Today, the field is completely being revolutionized by the possibility of offering many options for fertility preservations. And therefore, these patients that are now being diagnosed with cancer, and ideally before they start their cancer treatment, they are referred to reproductive specialists, and we do discuss with them the opportunity to cryopreserve their future options for having a family after they survived the cancer.
How did you initially become interested in this field?
Well, approximately 12 years ago, in talking with the colleagues at scientific meetings, there was the observation that there was this urgent need of filling a void in our discipline. In other words, we were starting to see more and more young patients, women and men, surviving cancer, and then starting to come to our practice asking for the opportunity to conceive after they were cleared from their oncologist. And really, 12 years ago, the field was not prepared to handle this type of patients, and then slowly but surely, with the effort of many of my other colleagues, we start to get together, and we created the Fertility Preservation Society in the realm of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, which was spearheaded by some other colleagues and myself. We were involved since the beginning. So it was really a need to fill a gap in our field of reproductive medicine, together with the observations that more and more patients, they've been successfully able to beat cancer.
Now, obviously, this is an enormous issue for many women who are undergoing cancer treatment or have had cancer treatment. How are they generally put in contact with you? Because this is obviously really important, but a lot of patients probably may not even be aware of such expertise or such specialists.
You are absolutely right. The work that has been done in the last decades has been monumental in this respect, because the oncologist, the pediatric specialist, the reproductive medicine doctors, urologists, and so forth, they never had the opportunity to work together on a big issue such as this one, which is fertility preservation. So by putting together a group of experts. In 2006, we wrote, together with the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the initial guidelines recommending and suggesting to oncologists that before they embark in proposing a chemotherapy protocol or radiotherapy protocol, to please be aware that there are options that women need to be informed about before they undergo cancer treatment. So that has been a great help. But a second big help, if not even more important than the first one, has been coming from patient organizations. And the one that started the process was one that was created by Lindsay Beck, and she created the Fertile Hope organization in New York, and she started to disseminate among patients and among also oncologists and reproductive specialists the information that we need to take care of fertility issues at the outset. And then this was joined by the Lance Armstrong Foundation, and there are so many now, many more organizations that are patients-driven, and they are really sensibilizing the public opinion on this very important issue. And third, as expert specialists in the field, we are also networking with many other colleagues around the world in a way that the same information, the same options are going to be made available not only here in the United States, but also in Europe and in other countries.
Have you found that other types of medical specialists, other physicians, have been responsive to these what sound like enormous efforts on your part and others to create awareness, identify for other physicians that your type of expertise is available? Have you seen an increase in referrals, an increase in patients coming to you for help ever since these programs were initiated?
Yes, we have seen here at the Yale Fertility Center an increase in the referral. So I can say that we have a very strong network and collaboration here with the Yale Cancer Center, with the breast cancer, with the pediatric oncologists. We are really very much united in this. However, in some other centers, it's a little bit more difficult because it is really a lot of work, like you said. It's a work that in order to be implemented, you really need to have a structure behind where the healthcare provider is in a way invested on a completely different aspect of the treatment plan. So ideally, to facilitate the filling this gap, will be best to have someone that is responsible for talking, for discussing the options for fertility preservation, let's say in an oncology practice, someone that is going to be designated as the person or a team, a couple of people that are going to be taking the name of this patient and start to inform of the various options, the various centers that can provide these options, where are they located, and so forth. But as you said, it's really a teamwork. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of resources, and that's one of the problems that maybe we will discuss later, that resources are not easily obtained for this type of work that is considered still experimental.
I think another issue may be that both for the patient and the oncology physician, when a new diagnosis of cancer is rendered, obviously that physician is probably very focused on their kind of treatment and their treatment plan for the patient. And the patient is, of course, having a tremendous amount of anxiety and is focused on getting their cancer treated as effectively and quickly as possible and may not be thinking so much about fertility at that time. So I think it's even that much more important to make sure that doctors and teams of medical professionals appreciate the kind of service and consultative work that you provide. What would you say is an ideal candidate for fertility preservation? What would be an ideal scenario?
An ideal scenario would be a young patient, post-puberty, whether married and already had one child and they still want to preserve an option for future children, or someone that has never had the chance to have a baby yet. And they can be referred and listen to the vast arrays of options that we can offer to them. So ideally, before chemotherapy or radiotherapy is initiated, that will be the best time for having a consultation. Although, if this cannot be obtained, because perhaps the initial diagnosis, the initial cancer diagnosis is rendering the patient so sick that there is no other possibility than starting the chemotherapy. Then, as you know, chemotherapy goes in cycles, and perhaps if there is a little hiatus, a little time between cycles, we can intervene at that time, as soon as the patient is stable and get the chance to be treated. Another problem that is also worthy to mention is that not every single type of cancer and every single type of chemotherapy is necessarily associated with infertility or with the sterility after cancer. So this is an important concept. However, while it's important, cannot be taken as a light, oh, okay, fine, I will have full recovery after chemotherapy, because even though we may be confident that some cancer, particularly when they are diagnosed in young age, are associated with a good chance of recovery of the menstrual function, it is important to have a discussion anyway, because even though you may recuperate, may recover the ovarian function, you may still suffer premature menopause, and therefore this discussion is better to be entertained regardless of the mild type of chemotherapy that a patient is receiving.
It's a little bit of a tangential subject, but you mentioned premature menopause. For our audience, can you describe that?
Premature menopause is when the ovarian function ceases before the age of 40. So when a woman has no more menses and she is 40, 41, while in North American Caucasian women, the age of menopause is about 51, 52, when the function ceases 10 years before, that's a premature menopause.
I see. And in terms of preserving fertility, assuming a woman is post-puberty, age is a significant factor. Is the likelihood of preserving fertility higher the younger the patient is?
Yes. Let me also elaborate a little bit more. Younger the age at diagnosis, there are two good news. One, that perhaps the reproductive function may be more protected because there are many more eggs in the ovaries. And two, that even though the insult from chemotherapy is powerful enough that for a year or 2 years after the end of the chemotherapy, the patient may be not having menses, then there is a likelihood that those menses may return. So younger age, better, what we say, better prognosis. If a woman is 35 or older, the chances that she may recuperate the ovarian function and the chance that she may be still able to have children with the menstrual function that has been recuperated is only 50% of what will be if she would not have been diagnosed by cancer.
I see. And in your practice, do you find that what's the percentage of patients that you see are self-referred, meaning the patient finds out about your expertise and makes an appointment for themselves, as opposed to a physician referring that patient to your service?
Prior to 2006, I would say it was a 50-50%, meaning 50% of the patients, they were finding us via a patient advocacy organization. But after 2006, now we have about 80% of the colleagues are referring patients, and only 20% are coming via internet or other organizations.
I see. So a lot of that effort, which I know is ongoing, that you've been working on with your colleagues to increase awareness, demonstrate that they're really experts specifically in this field, it sounds like it's really made a significant difference.
Correct. And there is still some more work to do, of course.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about fertility and cancer with Dr. Pasquale Patrizio.
The American Cancer Society estimates that over 1,000 patients will be diagnosed with melanoma in Connecticut each year. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable, and new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and today we're joined by Dr. Pasquale Patrizio, and we're discussing fertility and cancer. So, Dr. Patrizio, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about when is really the best time to have a consultation with a patient who's just received a diagnosis of cancer?
Ideally, fertility preservation options should be discussed and explored as soon as possible, ideally at the time of the diagnosis, and most importantly, prior to cancer treatment initiation. However, it's also important to remember that we need to take care on not adding further stress to the patient and family during a very difficult time. They just received the diagnosis of cancer. So we need to be, this has to be done with the team of experts, preferably some designated personnel in the care provider, that they will be the trait d'union between the cancer specialist and the reproductive infertility specialist. Today, with the vast array of options that we have available, it is really pretty much affordable to have a referral in 24 hours and provide some of the treatments options within a very short time frame. So in the old days, we were saying we need at least 6 weeks to offer some options. Well, today, these 6 weeks has been drastically reduced to no more than 2 weeks.
On a practical level, how would a patient actually get in touch with your office or your team?
Yeah, we do have a team of fertility preservation at the Yale Center. We have a dedicated number of colleagues that they are available for this type of referral with a very short notice. We have a nurse that works on this field, in this field. And then we also have our social worker that is available for providing counseling, emotional counseling to both patient and most of the time together with their parents. What is really a key is to have a team that is available 24/7 just to be there when we receive a phone call from our colleagues from the Yale Cancer Center or any other of the colleagues of the New Haven area or surrounding. Then once the initial contact is made, generally we have a 24 hours appointment time, and one of either myself or one of my colleagues, they will be seeing the patient that needs immediate attention.
Can you talk us through what a visit is like for a patient? You mentioned a little bit about the team and the importance of that, but when a patient actually comes to the office, who are they going to encounter first? What's it going to be like for them?
The first encounter is the nurse that is part of the clinical care team to this effect. And after they see the nurse, then they are going to see a physician. And specifically what is going to be addressed in the visit is find out first what type of cancer we are dealing with, where are we in the treatment plan, what is the future treatment plan, does the treatment involves chemotherapy and radiotherapy, what type of chemotherapy, and what time frame do we have. Is the chemotherapy in the future of a week, or is the therapy going to start tomorrow? Is the cycle already started? Is now, where are we now in between cycles, and so forth? So this has to be first assessed. As soon as we find out that, then we establish where the patient is in the menstrual cycle, and depending on where she is in the menstrual cycle, a treatment for collecting eggs, for example, can be started as soon as 2 or 3 days, or at the most within a week. And then all this explanation on what are the options are all going to be entertained. If the patient is single and is young, then the option that we prefer the most is to offer the freezing of eggs. If the patient is in a relationship, is married, then the second option is the possibility of freezing embryos. If the patient needs an immediate treatment, in other words, we do not even have the 3 days or 4 days for doing anything, because the treatment has to start tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, and is a treatment that involves radiotherapy, for example, like we have done a couple of cases as such, then what we discuss is ovarian tissue freezing, which is another option whereby we will collect strips of ovarian tissue, and then that ovary is going to be frozen for future use in the event the patient becomes menopausal or sterile after treatment. Then she still has some fragments of her ovarian tissue that can be retransplanted back to her once she's cured from cancer. In the world, the expertise throughout Europe mostly, and few cases also in the United States done by in St. Louis, there are now 18 babies that have been born by doing retransplants of a frozen, thawed ovarian tissue in patients that did not have any time for doing the standard egg freezing or embryo freezing.
Obviously, the three main treatments that a cancer patient might be facing are surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation treatment. How does each of those treatments specifically affect fertility in terms of the ovaries or other reproductive organs? Obviously, if we do surgery and things have to be removed, that's pretty straightforward. But how does radiation play into this? Chemotherapy, does it have to be radiation that's specifically targeted at the pelvic area, or can radiation to other parts of the body affect fertility? Can you comment on that?
Yes, obviously, radiotherapy with beams that are aiming at pelvic organs are definitely very toxic for the gonads, and therefore the recovery is very dismal. However, there are options in this case where you can transpose the ovary, you can remove the ovary from the pelvic location to higher up. However, you still have to be worried about the scattering of radiations once this treatment is performed. Next are the chemotherapy. Nowadays, the drugs that are used as a cocktail for treatment are much milder, much less gonadotoxic than before. But still, what is a problem for us in counseling is that we do not have a specific roadmap or a specific book of instructions saying, oh, if you take this particular cycle at this particular dosage at this particular chemotherapy, you are safe. Because the same cancer in two different patients that are using the same exact regime of chemotherapy may produce two different results in terms of ovarian recovery and toxicity for the eggs. So that's the unpredictable risk. And therefore, go back to your point, radiotherapy is the most ominous, the most worrisome, followed by prolonged cycles of chemotherapy, particularly with the alkylating agents such as cyclophosphamide, which are known to be toxic for the primordial follicles, for the very, very small eggs that are in the ovary.
Do you see men in your practice?
Well, we also see men, actually. This is also important for them to know that there are options for the men. The most effective, most well-established practice is freezing sperm. But also there are issues that need to be addressed. Sometimes there is a shyness, stress, and tension, and it's difficult to be able to produce a sample under such condition of duress. However, we do have again a team that will talk to the patient, try to make it at ease. We have a room just for collection. Sometimes we have to go to the hospital to do the collection because they are too sick. Sometimes they really cannot do it. Well, if they cannot do it, then we still offer the option of waiting for a cycle or two of chemo before we can still offer.
A question that often comes up is, after a patient's gone through a successful cancer treatment program, a male or a female, the question often comes up if they are interested in becoming pregnant, having a child, when is it really safe for them to try to do that?
Yeah, we have this concept of waiting 6 months after the ceasing of the chemotherapy for both men or women. If there is a resumption of sperm, there is a resumption of ovarian function after a washout time of 6 months, then she should be fine. To be also careful, though, that particularly for some patients, like with breast cancer patient, we do see a lot of breast cancer patients, and at that point, a pregnancy has to be considered in the realm of what type of cancer was originally diagnosed. Was an estrogen positive receptor cancer? Was progesterone receptor positive? HER positive? So this has to be all discussed in the context of a team with the oncologist, and having the okay for that particular patient after a period of time. Usually with the breast cancer, as you know, they undergo a treatment for about 5 years or so of tamoxifen, or depending on the stage of the cancer when it was diagnosed, they may just stop after 2 years or 3 years to give them the chance to have a pregnancy. Or perhaps we need to change the regime and not use tamoxifen and use letrozole, which is an aromatase inhibitor. But we do talk a lot with our colleagues here at Yale. So it's an interdisciplinary decision that benefits patient and also their family.
You had mentioned several options for women. Could you review those in some more detail? These various procedures, what it's actually like for a patient? Are the procedures done in the office? Do they need to be in the hospital or spend the night? Can you talk us through some of the more commonly performed procedures?
So the procedure that are performed in the office are egg freezing or embryo freezing. The embryo freezing is the most established one, is non-experimental, but egg freezing in the United States is still considered experimental. So these are the two most commonly used options. Next to that is the option of doing a laparoscopy surgery, whereby we obtained fragments or cortical pieces of the ovary. So this requires a patient that has to undergo anesthesia, and we need to do a surgical intervention to collect the ovarian tissue that is going to be frozen. So this is also considered experimental. So the established embryo freezing, experimental egg freezing, or ovarian tissue freezing. Now, there are some other options that are at the horizon, that are in the pipeline. Other options are, for example, if the patient does not have time to be stimulated with the medications to produce eggs, but when we see the ovary on the ultrasound, we can see that there are small follicles, which means they may have a harvest of those small follicles and we can get immature eggs. Well, today we are able to mature those eggs in the laboratory. So this is a non-surgical process. We aspirate those small follicles, we aspirate those immature eggs, and the patient can benefit of some of them being matured, and then they can be frozen or can be fertilized for embryo freezing. In the pipeline, what is at the horizon, and I want to make this comment because it's important for our research line that our patients understand, our public understand, that there are some cancers where we really have not too much time avail, for example, leukemia. A patient with leukemia When we receive the phone call, they are already so sick with high fever and debilitated, and the only option for them is to take a piece of ovarian tissue. However, as you know, leukemia is also a cancer that spreads all around the body and goes also to the ovary. So now, if I do an ovarian tissue harvest, then I cannot retransplant the tissue back to the patient when she is healed, because I may have a very high risk of transmitting back the cancer to that patient that is now healed. So what we are doing at Yale and so also in other centers, we are doing what we call in vitro folliculogenesis. In other words, we are trying to stimulate the growth of eggs from these ovarian pieces while the tissue is in a dish in the laboratory. And that's where we are hoping to achieve and make some stride. And also as another research that we would like to continue, and we are implementing a few more steps now, is the all ovary freezing and all ovary perfusion. In other words, if I take an entire ovary and I can attach this ovary to a peristaltic pump in the lab, I could theoretically keep this ovary alive for X number of days. And if there are leukemia cells, I'm not going to transplant this ovary. I'm just going to produce eggs in vitro, and then I can just discard the tissue.
Dr. Pasquale Patrizio is professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale School of Medicine and director of the Yale Fertility Center. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.